From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, November the 5th, 2019, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be talking with, just in a moment, with Justin Marsh of the Pride Center of Vermont about a new rule affecting adoptions and foster care placements involving LGBT families. And this is a proposed rule by the Trump administration, which a lot of LGBT activists are considered to be quite draconian and unfortunate. And we're going to find out why in just a couple of minutes. Before that, though, I wanted to mention that later on in the show this morning, we also have some exciting stuff going on. Stephen Wright, the deadpan comedian with the frizzy hair, who's been a guest on many late-night programs and has been a real national sensation from time to time throughout a long career in comedy, is coming to the Flynn Theater on November the 15th. And even better than that, from my perspective, he's coming to the Dave Graham Show a little bit after 10 o'clock this morning. And so you're all going to want to stay tuned for some really funny stuff from this guy. He is a unique performer on the comedy scene, and he does quite interesting work. It's a lot of it involving funny things with the language and so on. But so that'll be great. And then we're going to wind up the show later on in the second hour with a conversation with our good friend Senator Dick Sears. He's a Democrat from Bennington County. He's been in the Vermont Senate for a whole lot of years now. He's a real veteran of the state house scene, and Dick Sears is going to be talking to us about, you know, the state house is starting to get warmed up a little bit. Well, it's actually closed for some maintenance these couple of weeks, but there's a lot going on in terms of legislative hearings this November as lawmakers begin to look ahead to what's coming up in the formal session that begins in January and typically runs into May. And boy, they're getting ready, and we're going to be talking to Senator Sears about some of what's been going on in the as the lawmakers prepare to return to Montpelier. First of all, I want to introduce my first guest, who's Justin Marsh. He is communications director with the Pride Center of Vermont, based in Burlington. And Justin, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Of course, thanks for having me.
And first off, tell us a little bit about what is the Pride Center.
The Pride Center of Vermont is a community center, essentially, here in Burlington, but we provide statewide services for folks who are looking for HIV prevention, or experiencing intimate partner violence. We do trainings on LGBTQ best practices, and we're going to be down in the southern part of the state this weekend. So if you're in Bennington or Brattleboro, we'd love to say hi.
What kind of events are going on down there, and when and where?
It is the LGBTQ Town Hall that is happening in Bennington at on the Saturday at 4 p.m. Mm-hmm. at the college, and then in Brattleboro, it's at the out in the open, which I believe is in the Cotton Mill, and that's on Friday night at 6 p.m. So those are just places for folks to sort of let all of us know what's on their minds, what's going on for them in their communities, so that we have a better grip and to sort of take a pulse for queer people in those communities.
Interesting. Okay, well, that's good to get the word out about those events upcoming in southern Vermont in just a few days here. The main reason I wanted to have you as a guest this morning, Justin, was to talk about, I actually saw a story over the weekend in the Times Argus and Rutland Herald. The headline was, "Rule Would Impact LGBT Parents." And it's an Associated Press story by Kevin Freaking, and The story begins by saying the Trump administration on Friday proposed a rule that would allow faith-based foster care and adoption agencies to continue getting taxpayer funding even if they exclude LGBT families and others from their services based on religious beliefs. And maybe you could explain to us what you see happening here and what kind of an impact that would have on LGBT families.
Yeah, so the interesting thing with all of this is that the Trump administration has sort of been doing this sort of thing for the last 3 years, and we've been seeing sort of this rollback and this regression. And we actually had our you know, we knew this was kind of coming in June, that this was, you know, on the horizon. And it doesn't just affect parents. It affects, you know, elder services and the Head Start program, HIV prevention services. So it's a whole, pretty much anything that receives federal funds out of the Health and Human Services Department. And unfortunately, it's just like another example of them using religion to advance this regressive political agenda that really just harms others, essentially. So we're seeing it, I think this is getting the most headlines because it doesn't affect just adults. It's affecting children, really, when it comes down to it.
Yeah, do you have any sense of how many kids, I don't know, per year, or give us the right framework here, are adopted into LGBT households?
According to the UCLA in 2016, it was 21.4% of LGBTQ couples adopt versus 3% of heterosexual couples. So I don't really have a hard number as to what that equates to per person, mm-hmm. but in Vermont, there's about 140 youth waiting to be adopted, according to DCF. Nationwide, there's 440,000 people living in foster care, and 114,000 of those are unable to be reunited with their families. So they need to be adopted.
I think this point bears a little emphasis here, which is that we all know, and I think this has been the case for as long as I can remember, that there are waiting lines for children made up of children who are awaiting adoption. They're in foster care, or they're in some kind of state facility somewhere or whatever, and there are insufficient numbers of parents who are lining up to adopt these kids. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. So what that's doing is this rule is really just putting the provider's interest in discriminating essentially over the needs of these youth that are needing care. It's lessening the pool of adoptive parents.
And obviously, in an ideal world, you would have a fairly good match between the demand for adoptions, meaning the numbers of kids who need to be adopted, and the numbers of people who are able to and willing and actually really strongly, in many cases, desiring to adopt a child. That would match up better, but unfortunately, it does not.
Right.
And I mean, that's just, you know, to me, that just speaks to a degree of human suffering out there, which can be ratcheted up or down. It probably can never be eliminated, but you would think that that anybody with a even a religious ethic that said, I want to bring caring and love to the maximum degree I can in the world, would want to say, I'd like to see the maximum number of kids adopted into loving households, regardless of how those households are constructed or described or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. And I think one point that I'll make, too, is that, you know, these are usually faith-based adoption agencies that are the most likely to turn away a qualified LGBTQ couple. And I will say that a Pew study, I believe, a few years ago, there's about 60% of LGBTQ people who affiliate with a religion or a faith. And while that is, you know, less than a heterosexual person, that's still a lot of people who believe in religion and a faith. And if they were to go to a faith-based adoption agency, they are likely to be turned away more so because of their sexual orientation or their gender than, you know, their faith, which is interesting.
Are there cases you know of where a couple maybe welcomed themselves, you know, say, two men who are married or two women who are married welcome themselves into their local church and as members of the congregation, and then they say, we'd like to go to our church-affiliated adoption agency and adopt a child, and the church is telling them, I'm sorry, but our rules don't permit that.
Right. I don't personally know any situation like that, but I could imagine, I mean, we see time and time again that LGBTQ people do not feel welcomed in churches. They have felt, you know, uncomfortable going to places of worship. And so I think this just sort of heightens that sort of uncomfortability for our folks who are really just trying to have a family. They're trying to lessen the amount of children that are in the system and get them, you know, caring, loving homes and good care. Like, it's pretty, you know, cut and dried.
My guest is Justin Marsh. He's with the Pride Center of Vermont. Listeners, we welcome your calls. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255 is the toll-free number, 291-TALK. You can also call it that if you like. And we do have a caller on the line, Guy from Berlin. Good morning, Guy.
Dave, and good morning, Justin.
Hi.
I think you're from Cambridge originally.
I am. I still live there.
Well, then you would know, remember my two kids who used to come into the Cambridge Village Market, Joe and Imani, who were both.
I do.
Yeah, I figured you would. And we adopted them. First of all, thanks for doing this. And we adopted our two kids through an agency. One was a former priest and a former nun. And I don't know if they had a feeling about working with gay couples or not. I just don't remember. I do think that there are a lot of people out there who really care about kids, who really want to see adoptions happen, who do have really sincere, and it's not, you know, trying to be mean or venal or anything, just really sincere religious objections, and it's sort of hard on the other end of this. In addition to what you're saying, Justin, the other end of this is it's sort of hard to tell them, well, you can't do this anymore, or at least you can't have funding for it anymore, because of this. While they would be making a lot of really good adoptions happen as ours. So anyway, just a different angle on that.
Guy, I welcome you to the program, and I actually spoke with you last night, full disclosure for our listeners, because I was asking you if we could get any people rounded up who might be, take the opposite view here. We weren't able to line up any sort of formal guests in that regard this morning, but I appreciate your call, and I did want to ask you about this, because you mentioned the funding, and that's where I think a lot of folks might see the rub here. Let's sort of put aside for the moment, just kind of for the sake of argument or whatever, the questions about LGBT couples as adoptive parents and so on and so forth, and focus for a moment on the fact that the government now is providing funding to a religious organization, and I have questions about that from the get-go, because the First Amendment, the very first words in the First Amendment to the Constitution are, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So the very first amendment in the Bill of Rights deals with is government's neutrality about religion. We're not promoting religion, and right. we are not tamping down on religion.
And so I guess the point there, Dave, is that when you have an organization that is providing the same service as a secular organization, mm-hmm. it should be discriminated against because it has a religious foundation. That would be a reason why, you know, these faith-based, not even so much adoption, because adoption generally can be funded without a lot of government funding. I mean, certainly that's how we did ours. Mm-hmm. But the foster care, that's a whole different story. And you have people, not only faith-based agencies, but faith-based people. I know some. They're wonderful foster parents. And they've at times gotten a little bit of pushback from the system because maybe they say grace. And maybe they expect everyone at their home to go to church with them. Because these are the rules of their home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a that's another end of this, is that not only the secular agency, the religious agency, putting restrictions on.
Well, I think it's a really interesting analogy, because I'm trying to articulate a principle here, which says that if you want to participate, if you want to sort of take advantage of our what we're offering, sometimes you've got to some degree follow our rules. And so I would tend to sympathize with the foster parent who says, I want to welcome foster children to my home, but by the way, when they're here, they're going to be saying grace every night before dinner. Okay, that's a house rule, and that's what we do, et cetera. And you know, I've been to Passover Seders. I'm not Jewish, but I've been to Passover Seders where I sort of try to, you know, I don't know the Hebrew prayers and stuff, but I try to make it a practice to you know, behave in certain ways that comport with what's going on there, if you know what I mean. So I get that. And by the same token, if I want to sign up for a government program, and this government has, say, anti-discrimination laws that say thou shalt not discriminate against LGBT people, and I want the money, I might have to comport with the rules of the program or not accept the money. It's one or the other, I would think, but that's just it's kind of where I'm coming down in this. Otherwise, you do have a situation where it is a particular or even peculiar situation where a particular religious faith doesn't want to accommodate gay and lesbian folks, and if that is their right, I don't see why a gay and lesbian taxpayer should be expected to pay for that. That's kind of where I'm coming down on this right now. I mean, obviously, I'm open to counter argument and possibly even changing my view. But I do think that there is a principle there that why would a gay and lesbian taxpayer want his or her tax dollars to go to support a program which is going to discriminate against him or her? I think that's what do you think about that guy? Guy's gone. Okay. Hey, let's get another caller in here. Rama. Good morning, Rama.
Listen, I'll be real quick here, but you know, I'm speaking from experience as being both a foster parent and having an adopted daughter. And you know, the truth is, what they're looking for has nothing to do with the kids and has nothing to do with the families that are going to take the children in. I know people who I wouldn't necessarily agree with their household rules who have taken in kids who needed a good, steady household to live in. And bless them for doing it, whether I agree with them or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's the organizations that are taking our money, that are being given the extra sway because now they have the money and they have the power to direct things. Not their money. They have our collective money, tax dollar monies that came from a secular government, and they are using it to shove their religion. And this is what it's about, the ability of them to shove their religion down our collective throats, whether we want it or not. What they're doing, make no mistake, this has nothing to do with the kids. This is about political and monetary control.
Okay, thanks for the call, Rama. Appreciate that. Justin, I want to get you back into the conversation here because you, after all, are the sort of formal guest here, and I wanted to just check in with you. I mean, what do you think about this First Amendment issue where we're really examining government's kind of role or position vis-a-vis religious organizations?
Yeah, it's interesting to take a step back and actually look at the fact that that's happening in the first place. And then, and I think, you know, these Christian-based services, like we've seen them in several different states close down because they were no longer receiving the HHS money. And I think, you know, from an organizational standpoint, they need to weigh what, you know, kind of like to Rama's point, is it the fact that they're in it for the children and the welfare of other folks, or are they in it because to push their religion? And what you have to weigh those two options. What matters most to them? And if it truly is their religion, then we're seeing them close down because they can't sustain themselves without those taxpayer dollars. And this rule is an abuse, essentially, of taxpayer dollars. And it turns around and instead empowers the hatred and bigotry towards these marginalized community members.
I would suspect that this rule also will quickly draw litigation, some kind of a lawsuit, just based on these First Amendment issues. Where, again, it is a strong tradition in American jurisprudence that government neither tamps down on religion or promotes religion. And it sure seems like in this case here, to say that we're going to give taxpayer dollars to organizations that want to discriminate against LGBT families, I find that to be way over the line, frankly, into the realm of government support for religion. Don't you?
Yeah, and we've seen the ACLU has already, you know, they're always suing someone, and they have sued the Trump administration for signing a waiver to allow a South Carolina organization to continue to receive HHS funding while also turning away people based on their faith or their sexual orientation. So, yeah, this conversation is a great one to be having, because it does sort of spark that conversation about funding and where our money is going and who's it serving. And it's really interesting. And I think Rama made a great point there, too.
I mean, actually, that you bring up a really interesting point here, which this could go well beyond LGBT households to say it's a religious organization that essentially says we don't want any non-Christians darkening our door.
Yeah, we're seeing that happening. Yeah, there's countless stories of, you know, Jewish women who are turned down, and, you know, just because of their religion. So it goes beyond. I mean, it could probably open up to race too. Wouldn't be surprised.
Well, you know, I understand. I mean, I don't mean to completely dismiss out of hand the idea that people have certain religious values that they really hold on to very dearly, and I mean, I may disagree with what they're doing. My approach tends to be somewhat laissez-faire in terms of just to say, unless people are sort of being actively harmed, the Catholic Church doesn't allow women to become priests, which you could say that's a case of sex discrimination prima facie, right? I mean, it's just it's kind of an obvious thing where most organizations are required to at least theoretically allow women to rise up to any position within their ranks, and the Catholic Church doesn't do that, and so this is a couple thousand years of faith tradition in the Catholic Church, I guess, that dictates that women can't be priests, and in some ways, part of me says, well, I'm okay with them doing that, providing everybody who gets into who's going to Catholic Church understands those are the rules, and if you're a woman, you're never going to be a priest. I don't want to see my tax dollars going to support that policy. However, I think there's a big, bright line, which you know separates is kind of that let them do what they will do, within certain limits. Obviously, human sacrifice, it's been practiced by some religions around the world. We don't like that, but and other really behaviors that are just beyond the pale. But I think that there's this kind of a sliding scale there. I guess I'm not articulating this very well, but on the other hand, when it comes down to the public's money going towards something, then it really does need to follow the public's rules, which are codified in law and anti-discrimination laws, etc. And it's the law of the land now that gay and lesbian folks can get married, and that's the way it is. And people kind of have to either acknowledge that and live with it, or they need to acknowledge that they're not going to get public money, I would think. But that's just my take on the situation. Have you seen other examples here of the Trump administration seemingly targeting LGBT folks? We're just down to the last couple of minutes here. I don't know if you have any other sort of cases that bear watching on this front.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it throughout the last 3 years where with trans health, we've seen it with HIV prevention services are getting these same types of this go-ahead by the administration to reject people and turn them away. And it really goes against the Health and Human Services mission, which is to preserve public health. So by doing this, we're seeing an increase in stigma and prejudice that then leads to things like suicide and addiction. We're already struggling with that as a society. Intimate partner violence, we've seen a huge increase here at the Pride Center in folks who are experiencing intimate partner violence and discrimination in the workforce. And I think this is all, it's sort of a trickle-down effect from the Trump administration and the different things in society that are being put in place where this hatred and this bigotry is seen as okay and justifiable. And it's making times a little bit more difficult for all.
Yikes. Well, lots of work to do. That is absolutely clear. Justin Marsh of the Pride Center of Vermont, I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning. Tough issue, interesting conversation, and let's talk as the thing unfolds, and we'll figure out if there's another show to be done on this.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
We are going to go to a bottom of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show. Don't forget about our podcast, folks. If you want to catch up with what we've been doing and didn't hear it on live, you can always go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link to the Dave Graham Show, scroll down a bit, and find our recent podcasts. So, good way to catch up. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with more of the Dave Graham Show. Stay with us.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our rockin' deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smart Wool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
My guest for at least the next few minutes is Stephen Portnoy. He's a correspondent with CBS News. And Stephen, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, you bet. Good to be with you this morning.
You've been following the impeachment inquiry, and I just wanted to get caught up on recent developments. One I saw just this morning is a story in the New York Times reminding us that Roger Stone is still facing charges. In fact, his trial starts this week.
Election this morning, in fact.
Yep.
And, you know, that's one of the things that are swirling around all this. Another development yesterday, the Second Circuit Appeals Court in New York City ruling that the president doesn't have the kind of immunity that he asserts when it comes to his ability to prevent prosecutors from getting their hands on his tax returns and business records. The Second Circuit panel ruled unanimously yesterday that whatever immunity from prosecution the president might theoretically enjoy certainly does not extend to his accounting firm. And the prosecutors in Manhattan can go after the records of that accounting firm, even if they happen to belong to the sitting president of the United States.
I've had a thought recently that with all the focus on Ukraine and this alleged quid pro quo, et cetera, that some of the stuff from the recent past is going to get lost. And in other words, a lot of the material in the Mueller report, all the accounts of the obstruction of justice, and as well all the contacts with Russia and so on. And maybe this stuff these embers are not quite extinguished yet. I mean, it seems like this Stone stuff clearly stems from the 2016 activities, right?
Right. I can tell you that Democrats are going to try to thread the needle when it comes to, and by the way, so too is the president going to try to thread the needle in a different direction, sort of tying all of these things into one package. Let's take it from the president's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
He, for example, wants an investigation into what he sees as corruption in Ukraine, because it goes back to 2016 as well. And this idea that either the Ukrainians helped hack the Democrat National Committee, not the Russians. Some people close to the president have it in mind, even though people who have worked in this White House have specifically told the president that there is no reason to believe that that's true. We got the idea that maybe the Ukrainians had a hand in the early reporting in 2016 about Paul Manafort's business dealings in Ukraine when he was paid to be an advocate for the pro-Russian forces in Ukraine, for which he was later tried and convicted of hiding that money from the IRS. The president seems to believe that the unearthing of that information and reporting of it in the summer of 2016, when Manafort was his campaign chairman, was some amount of foreign intervention or meddling, and he says he wants to get to the bottom of that.
Let me stop you for one second, if I could, though, because a lot of the meddling that actually did happen and was traced to this Internet Research Agency, which I remember had an IP address based in St. Petersburg, Russia, nowhere in Ukraine.
That's correct. That's right. Exactly. So that's why the president's former Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert said in an interview this fall that he personally told the president there was no reason to believe this conspiracy theory that the Ukrainians played a role in the hacking. He told the president it was the Russians.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's not only no reason to believe the Ukrainian theory, but there's strong evidence to suggest that the hacking originated in Russia.
I mean, it's certainly the belief of the intelligence community. But this president has said that from a number of perspectives, there are reasons he doesn't believe the intelligence.
They're all the deep state out to get him or something. I can't really give these things, these sort of alternative theories, equal weight in my mind. I mean, maybe that's just me, but there's so much more evidence to support the Russia being the main actor in the 2016 meddling as opposed to Ukraine that I find the Ukrainian theory to be pretty much a desperate ploy. I mean, I don't know how else to get there, but
I can assure you from my vantage point here in Washington, you are not the only one who thinks so.
Yeah. I do think we really do want to get to the facts here, and we want to follow the evidence and the strongest amounts of evidence where they actually lead. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, rooting for one team over the other here. It would be great to actually, you know, get to the bottom of this stuff and figure out, you know, who the bad actors are and what bad actions took place. That's what you hope for, I would think. But I don't know. That doesn't seem to be universally the case. So,
I'll just say we live in an era where increasingly people are suspicious of motives, suspicious of intent. And that's why it's interesting to read the transcripts of these depositions that are coming out this week.
Mm-hmm.
These depositions taken over the course of the last month or so in the House Intelligence Committee. Yesterday, Marie Yovanovitch, the former ambassador to Ukraine, ousted earlier this year, was mentioned specifically in the phone call between the president and Volodymyr Zelensky over the summer, in which he referred to her as bad news and said that she's going to go through some things. Is the phrase the president employed according to the summary of the call that the president released this year. Marie Yovanovitch, a career Foreign Service officer, people close to the president believe that she may have tried to block the efforts to investigate Burisma, and therefore she had to go. At least that's the operating theory here. And the idea that the president saw her as bad news because she was, I guess in her mind, sticking up for what she knew to be true as opposed to propagating a conspiracy theory to benefit the president's political aims, that is what the Democrats say ultimately amounts to an abuse of power.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of reads like a script from The Sopranos, you know? I mean, the old mobster show that was all the rage a decade or two ago. I mean, you know, this idea that Maria Yovanovitch is supposed to watch my back, you know, and that kind of stuff. I guess that's the way ball is played in the various very highest levels of government these days. Is that what we should take from this?
Key phrases these days, and the idea that, you know, when you're talking about people who are operating under color of law, with the authority of the U.S. government, paid for by taxpayers to act in the name of the people, this is where people start to say, wait a second.
I'd give it 2 or 3 seconds. Well, Stephen Portnoy, I really appreciate you joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you guys, and thanks for joining us.
You bet.
We have sort of a good stable of kind of folks I think of as kind of friends of the show. These are people who are frequent guests or occasional callers to the show. I count Guy Page among them. He's a great guy. He's from, no pun intended, he's from Berlin. He's very active in, he actually has a couple of publications that cover the Vermont State House from a generally conservative perspective. Very thoughtful gentleman, and he called in during the first hour our discussion about the this proposed rule that would impact LGBT parents and their ability to adopt children or take children into foster care. And Guy got off the line before I had a chance to thank him for his call, but I really appreciate that. When another good friend of the show who is sometimes guest and sometimes caller is Kevin Ellis, and I believe he's joining us on the line right now. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, David.
I appreciate you jumping on in short notice here, but I kind of wanted to catch up with you on a couple different layers of politics going on, both in Vermont and nationally. Just so much interesting stuff happening. Let's start with Vermont, actually. The Republican Party the other day reelected Deb Bilodeau, their chair of the state party. And that's very interesting because she obviously has a certain style of Republican politics that do not square a lot of times, it seems, with those of the leading Republican elected official in the state, that being Governor Phil Scott.
Boy, that isn't that for sure. I was reading the V.T. Digger piece about it that quoted Senator Brock as wishing that she would tone things down a bit. I think, for me, it puts Senator Brock and Senator Benning and Governor Scott in a difficult position because they're going to have to always, on a weekly basis, sort of distance themselves from her remarks, which are so right-wing and so pro-Trump that it's going to be very difficult to run Republicans for office in the legislature while she is out spouting the Trump manifesto. Puts them in a tough position, I think.
Yeah, and I just wonder, going forward, how does this tree continue to survive after a lightning strike like this? You know, I mean, I that's the metaphor that comes immediately to mind, is just a bolt of lightning comes down, splits a tree in two, really. Is that tree going to continue to prosper?
Well, no. I think the Republican tree in Vermont is dead. But we are in an era, Dave, where with technology and social media, where the party is, in my view, irrelevant anyway. They have a good list, but other than the voter contact list, both the Democratic and the Republican Party are really shells. And that these candidates run as their own individual brands, whether you're Phil Scott or Peter Shumlin or Barack Obama or Donald Trump. You know, these people create their own, basically their own nonprofit organizations for 2 years, mm-hmm. fund them and run their campaigns based on them. I don't think Phil Scott will be hurt by Deb Bilodeau's right-wing politics, but it's just another example of how the modern political party in the internet age is becoming less and less relevant, in my view.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the case, in which case, does that open the possibility? A lot of folks have talked to, especially, you know, people I know on the left have sort of, I think fantasized over the years about creating a strong third-party movement, you know, with progressive politics and et cetera. This doesn't seem to open the door to that, though, does it? This dissolution to some degree of the original, or I don't know if it's dissolution, but maybe just kind of atrophying or something of the two major parties.
I agree with you 100%. All you have to do is, you know, old guys like us, ask a child in your house whether they give a darn about the Democratic National Committee.
Never mind a child, my adult, my 28 and 30 year old sons, I'm sure if I asked them that, they would go, well, yeah, actually they should, if they were at the bottom of the ocean, that would be a start or something, you know.
Right. I mean, this next generation that's about to take over this country, they don't care about the RNC or the DNC or the Vermont Democratic Party.
And so, you know, they're looking at the field of candidates nationally and on a state level and saying, do I agree with them? Do I like what they say? What do they stand for? So I think Deb Bilodeau is irrelevant to Phil Scott's fortunes, but boy, does it make it very tough to build any kind of Republican grassroots infrastructure in the state.
Yeah, I sympathize, frankly, with a lot of Republican people whom I respect. I mean, I'm looking at this quote in 7 days from Heidi Sherman, who's a state rep from Stowe, and you know, I like the kinds of debates that she is in the middle of on the Republican side in the House chamber, because she's pro-business. She wants to keep a lid on taxes. She sort of has this very practical, I think, approach to a lot of issues that come up in the House. And there are a number of lawmakers like her. I don't mean to just single her out as alone, but you know, it's a healthy debate in Vermont when you can actually have this sort of traditional Republican perspective, and then the Democrats on the other side of the debate, and they can hash out whether paid family leave really makes sense and how that should be designed if we're going to do it, and et cetera, et cetera. That's a working system, if you ask me. If you have this real fissure on the Republican side to the point where the party has lost some cohesion, then I think that's kind of a shame, personally.
I agree. I never thought I'd hear myself say, thank goodness for Heidi Sherman. because we really need her voice. We really do. And in the Senate, you need Joe Benning and Randy Brock. And because you're right. Otherwise, the Democrats are just debating between the Bernie Sanders wing of the party and the more centrist wing of the party, the Mitzi Johnson wing of the party. So, the Heidi Shermans, those moderate to conservative Republicans from yesteryear, I just wish that they would, I wish they would stand on the statehouse steps and reject Trumpism completely, because then I think once they're rid of that stain, then I think they can move ahead and create something that's real, real Republicanism.
Yeah, is this being played out nationwide? I mean, is Vermont here just a microcosm of what's going on in the party nationally? Certainly in the first couple of years of the Trump administration, it seems like the Republican Party nationally was in lockstep with him. But I sort of wonder whether there are other states where you're seeing in the internal ranks of the party a lot of this kind of dissension.
Well, I think it is going on, but it's pretty clear that the dissension in the ranks is kept quiet. And you see it on the national scale where, you know, Republicans in Congress tell reporters, Scott, I can't stand the president. He's outrageous. And yet they are so afraid of the ascendant right wing, the Tea Party, of being primaried from the right, that they move to the right and defend Trump. And I just keep wondering when there's going to be what I call a Joseph Welch moment, when the famous lawyer stood up to Joe McCarthy, when some Republican is going to make a principled stand and say to, you know, publicly, have you no decency? Somewhere along the line, if we're going to be saved, some Republican is going to stand up and say that. And I wish Phil Scott would do it. I don't think it's his personality to do that kind of thing.
Probably. That's my guess, too, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Hey, we have a caller on the line. Let's hear what Don from Elmore has to say about all this. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, fellows. I look at this whole situation, and you look at the number of people that are actually getting out and voting in these last few years, particularly in presidential races. And as near as I can see, the number is going down. The percentage of the total number of registered voters is going down every year. What does that tell me? It tells me that everybody is so fed up with both parties, they just can't get interested enough to go out and vote anymore. I mean, the Democrat Party, to me, has morphed into the Communist Party of the U.S. because it's controlled by the federal employees union and the teachers unions all over. The Republican Party morphed into the Tea Party. Now it's morphed into the Nazi Party of America, controlled by Führer Trump. If we can't get better candidates than Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton to run for president in this country, it's going to come to an end. And I don't think anybody can complain about the way the Republican Party has gone without looking at what Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Hillary Clinton pulled off in the last election. Donna Brazile's book is the best public confession I've ever seen. She should have done it beforehand. They cost Bernie Sanders the presidency.
Let me ask you, Don, would the Democrats have been better off to have nominated Bernie Sanders? I mean, is there any fear that he would have scared too many people off?
I would ask whether he scared any more people off than Donald Trump did.
Well,
I mean, I did not vote for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. I voted against Hillary Clinton, and I know there's an awful lot of people that did that.
Yeah, I'm still trying to put my finger on exactly what it was that gave people such a bad taste in their mouths about Hillary Clinton that they did vote for Donald Trump, pretty much knowing that he was a personality unlike any other, shall we say, that has ever sought the presidency.
That's true, but he has been honest in what he has said, and he has been consistent. Do I agree with Bernie on everything he says? Heck no, but I know that I can trust him with his word.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton was making all kinds of noise about how she has supported the Black Caucus and done everything she can for the African Americans in this country, and yet she ignored her own husband and would not go into South Chicago. She would not go into Baltimore. She would not go into Detroit.
Yeah.
I mean, the woman shot herself in the foot.
That does seem to be the case. Hey, Don, I got to jump, but I appreciate the call. You have a lot of good thoughts here, and stay in touch. Kevin Ellis, let me ask you, what about some Democratic soul searching here? We just have a couple minutes to go, but the Democrats have a pretty big split nationally between the Sanders Warren wing and the, shall we say, the Hillary Clinton Joe Biden wing.
Boy, they sure do, and I'm of the opinion that Joe Biden will light himself on fire in the next month or so and finish a distant fourth in the Iowa caucus and then be out of the race. So it's I don't know where it's going to go, but you're right. You're going to see this split play out on the national stage. And someone like Don, who I agree with a lot of what he just said, he's going to face a choice that's going to be really, really interesting, and so am I, about, you know, do you vote for Elizabeth Warren and a Medicaid for All proposal? I think, you know, I got to tell you, I think Don's completely right about the Democrats and how they took it away from Bernie Sanders. I think he would have beaten Trump.
All right, Kevin Ellis, that's about all the time we have. I appreciate you stopping in on telephonically here on the Dave Graham Show, and thanks for doing so. We'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure.
CBS News at the top of the hour, and then we're going to bring in a special guest, Stephen Wright, the comedian. He's going to be performing in Burlington in a couple weeks. We're going to get a preview. Stay with us, folks.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our rockin' deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smartwool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV-FM and AM.
And we are back. We have a really fun segment upcoming, I think, here, and that is with the comedian Stephen Wright, who's going to be appearing at the Flynn Theater on Friday evening, November the 15th. That's a week from Friday, folks. Get your tickets now. And he's also going to be, I happen to be tooling around downtown Concord, New Hampshire this weekend. I won't mention why, but I was just over there and saw on a movie marquee, what looked like a movie marquee, it was actually on the Capitol Center, right on Main Street in downtown Concord, that Stephen Wright is going to be there on the 16th. So if you miss him in Burlington on the 15th, there's another chance to catch him here in northern New England. And very happy to say Stephen Wright is my guest this morning for the next few minutes here on the Dave Graham Show. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. And how are you?
Excellent.
And I was wondering, you you are in a on a tour here. Where else around New England? And of course, New England is your home stomping grounds. You grew up in Cambridge, Mass, right?
I was born in Cambridge, but I grew up in Burlington, Massachusetts.
Okay, and still got that good Boston accent. I love it. I grew up in Swampscott myself, so I know the lingo. And tell me a little bit about your upbringing. Did you have a happy childhood in Burlington, Massachusetts?
Yeah, it was very very normal. It was like, the town is built up a lot now, but it was very rural, borderline suburbia, rural, lots of trees, lots of fields, lots of woods, and we had some horses, and it was very Norman Rockwell, Little League baseball, right?
Oh, yeah.
Bikes, you know,
and you must
no
have
crime in the town.
You must have had some experience growing up, and maybe as a teenager or something, painting your neighbor's houses, because one of your most famous lines has to do with painting. that one about it's a small world, but I wouldn't want to paint it.
And, oh yeah, I painted a lot in college. After college, I painted the dorms in the school in Emerson College in Boston, and.
Uh-huh.
You can. I thought a lot of comedy when I painted, because painting is so boring. You know, painting rooms. I mean, and then I've painted since I was like in fifth grade. Done paintings. I have a lot of abstract paintings I have on my website.
So you're both an artistic painter and a house painter or whatever. I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Both. And one time in. Summer of, I don't remember, I was in right out of high school, and I was living in Burlington, and I had a summer job painting the schools, the schools in Burlington, and we had to paint the high school, we had to paint the big cafeteria in the high school, and I reserved a wall for myself, this big white wall down the end, you know, brick white wall, and I painted with a wide blue brush. I painted an abstract version of The Last Supper across this wall. It's like 8 feet tall and 25 feet wide.
Now, wait a minute, Stephen. Hang on. This is a religious display in a public school. You might have had a First Amendment problem there, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, but not then, though. That was before the Spaceship of Rules came down.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah, those
there
are, it was a freer time back then, maybe.
But, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So do you have a dog these days?
No, I have a lot of dog jokes, but I don't have a dog.
You don't have
if
a dog?
I need a dog, I can get you a dog.
Did your paranoid retriever die?
Oh, yeah, I still have him, yeah.
Yeah, and what's special about a paranoid? I mean, as opposed to a Labrador retriever or a golden retriever, what's special about a paranoid retriever?
Oh, he brings back everything because he's not sure what I threw him.
Yeah, right.
That's that joke. Yes. Yeah.
I have to. Apparently, you have to feed you little prompts here, Stephen. You're gonna. Can you give us any kind of a preview? Just a taste. I don't want to, spoiler alert and all that, but what are you going to tell us on the 15th?
Oh, I'm going to be talking about Christmas and Jesus and lint and the speed of light and gravity and women and cars. And
sounds like a fairly broad range of topics.
Yeah, I'll be talking for about 85 minutes, and I change the subject every 5 seconds. So what is that? 5 times 85 is 60 minutes. I don't know, thousands of different subjects. thousands.
and Do you write the stuff ahead of time, or do you make it up as you go?
Oh, my God. I wish I could make it up as I go. No, it's all written before. I'm, like, delivering what I've written. I'm like a, rather than an author who writes a book, I come out and say the book.
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
Yep.
You know.
So if I talk to a saxophone player, they'll tell me they idolize John Coltrane or Lester Young or Coleman Hawkins or whatever. So you're a comedian. I'm going to ask you what comedians who in the genre preceded you especially admire.
Oh, absolutely, George Carlin. He was one of the reasons I wanted to do this from seeing him on the Tonight Show and Woody Allen. He made a double comedy album before he made movies. Him and Richard Pryor. And when I was like in 10th grade, there was a radio show in Boston, and I found it on every Sunday night. I stumbled upon it because I was trying to get the Bruins, but I accidentally got this thing one night. And the guy played two comedy albums every Sunday night, two entire albums.
Wow.
And I tuned into that show for about 2 years, and I would be like in my bed with my radio, and he had everything you could imagine, a 2,000-year-old man with Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and just everything. So I was like studying it without knowing it. I'm laying there thinking, wow, look at this writing. That's how I learned how to write a joke from Woody Allen's albums. And I love a lot of comedians.
It's interesting to me you mentioned George Carlin first, because some of your stuff actually reminds me a little bit of him in the way you sort of make fun of the language and just the spoken word conventions that we all have. You know.
Yeah, there's a lot of twists on words and stuff. And what I got mainly from him was he would talk about everyday things, like all the everyday stuff that everyone deals with. That's why that list that I was telling you that I'm going to talk about, I talk about everyday stuff. I don't talk about politics or giant, like, rock stars or giant companies or anything or TV stars. It's all little tiny things, and I got that from listening to him. I twist it different than he did, but that's from his influence.
You twist it differently from the way George Carlin did, but maybe the roots were similar before the tree grew and you got hit by the whatever winds are occurring to you. Because I'll tell you, it does seem like you got to march to a different drummer to do this, don't you?
You got to just not overthink what you're doing and just present how your mind works.
Yeah.
You know? There's no like plan. There's no like, should I be like this? Should I talk like this? Should I do like this? It just comes out naturally.
Yep.
You know, like when one of your friends, or you're hanging out in a bar, and one of your friends is always funnier than the other friends. It's in you. It's just a thing that's inside of you.
Sure.
I feel very lucky to be able to do this and to do it this long.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's fun creating.
How long have you been at it, Stephen?
40 years.
Wow. That's quite a run. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Can I bring in a caller on the show here?
Sure.
Mike from Berlin. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Steve. Do you remember Paul Lane in Cambridge, Mass, going back into the 80s?
Paul what?
Paul Lane.
Oh, yeah. I remember his name. I remember that name.
He used to work in a laboratory in Watertown, Mass. I remember you came in to visit him, and you gave us quite the show.
Really? He wasn't a comedian then.
No, he wasn't a comedian, but you were. And both of you went off, and it was pretty funny. You made me laugh, and you're still making me laugh.
Well, wait, Mike. You were working in a laboratory in Cambridge, and Stephen came in for a visit and met with Paul Lane, and the two of them put on a little comedy routine for you?
Well, it wasn't really a comedy routine. He just came in and busted our, you know what.
Yeah.
Probably had a funny conversation. I must have known him and went in to visit him. Is that how it worked?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was in Watertown, Mass. We're going back to the 80s, brother.
Yeah.
I remember that name, definitely.
Yeah, I haven't seen Paul since, I think, 1990, and hopefully he's well. And again, I haven't talked to you, and it's been a while, so hope all is well with you.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Yeah, I can't complain. I'm getting old. I'm getting cranky and stuff like that, and I'm just about 2 months older than you.
Yeah, the thing about being any age is no one's ever been the age that they're at. It's all new.
We
every Absolutely. Single second is new, like the front of a boat, like when the boat goes through the water.
Wow. There's a profound philosophy there. Hey, Mike, thank you for the call. That's really interesting.
Thanks.
Stephen,
I want to
pursue that idea of everything being new, because I've been in a couple of situations where folks getting old and going toward either lost my father-in-law this past summer, and watching the family go through that was like we were the first family ever to have gone through such a thing. And, now my mom's 90 and she's getting a little bit of dementia or something. And again, all these issues come up and I'm thinking to myself, how many millions of other families have gone through exactly the same thing? But it all seems like a complete mystery to us.
It's everyone. Everyone goes through it or is going through it.
So your idea of that, of the boat piercing the water, is kind of that's a really interesting metaphor there. I think that's
well, I just thought of that right now, but I have thought before that, you know, as in a funny way, to say to a friend of mine, I'm not this age. I'm not used to it. I've never been this age.
How old,
I'm 63. I'll be 64 next month.
Wow. Okay.
But you could say that when you were 19. You could say that when you were 8. Almost like a fake. It's like a synthetic excuse for not being able to handle a situation because you've never been in the situation before. If I never skied, I never skydive, I never, built a chair. The first time you can say, I've never done this before. So to say that about your actual age is like a fake excuse. Even though it's true. It's true and fake at the same time. You and I are what? What were you going to say?
You and I are about the same age. So I'm 63 also, in fact. I turned 64 in March. But I guess one of the things that I've noticed, tell me if you have, that time seems to fly by faster and faster.
Yes, that is incredible. I don't know why that is, the older you get. Time is like a trick. Imagine a snail is walking on the arm of a chair. A snail is just crawling around. You have a camera on the snail. And then when the camera pulls back, you see that the arm of the chair is in a plane, on a jet. Like you see the snail through the window of the jet. Now the camera is further back, so now you see the whole jet. So the jet's going like 500 miles an hour. But the snail is just crawling along, and it's like that's how our lives are. We're like seem to be crawling, but we're whipping through space at the same time.
Isn't that amazing? Wow, huh? You got to think about stuff like that, because when you show up at the Flynn Theater on Friday evening, November the 15th, it's going to be funny as all get out. So
as long as I can come out and remember what I'm going to say, that'll be good.
Well, how do you do that? Do you have like a teleprompter, or do you actually have to memorize all your lines, all your thousands of lines?
It has to be in my head already. You learn early on. One of the first things you learn in the first couple times of ever doing it is you better know what you're going to say next. You can't be stumbling around. So all comedians' brains are like, amazing memory machines, at least for the show. Then you might not know where you parked your car, but
You gotta get done with your show, and you've been leaning on this memory like really, really hard in a fine grained way for 85 minutes, as you say. That's almost an hour and a half. Holy cow, man! And you go outside and where's my car? Yeah. I could imagine that being the case, because you got more important things to think about than where the hell is your car. So, but
I love doing the show, and hopefully you can see the show sometime.
Yeah, you're going to be in Burlington on the 15th and Concord, New Hampshire, on the 16th. And any other New England dates coming up?
No, I'll be in Albany the 14th.
Wow.
And then I'll go to Florida. I just did a bunch of shows. I did one in Connecticut, and I was out in somewhere in the Midwest. But thank you very much. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Stephen.
Do it again sometime.
Yeah, check in next time you're in town. It's great. Here's a typical Stephen Wright line. He says, I've been writing a book. I've got all the page numbers done. I just haven't filled in the rest. And very self-deprecating and kind of and delivered in that deadpan style. It just reminds me of the way people talked as I was growing up, because that does seem to be part of certain parts of New England where the there's a style of talking which is pretty unaffected and unexcited, and you're sometimes the funniest stuff you hear will be said in the voice of somebody who sounds just bored to tears. So anyway, that is it's a fascinating approach to comedy he's got, and I'm thinking I might have to see about getting tickets to that Burlington show myself. So anyway, the Dave Graham Show continues here. We got a little time for some calls from our listeners out there. And anybody remember any good Stephen Wright one-liners you want to share with us? Or if anybody wants to call us up and tell us that I've got it completely wrong about Ukraine and Russia and President Trump and all the rest of that, you're welcome to jump in with that stuff. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And another Mike. We got Mike from Facetown this time. Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Dave. Hey, I wanted to talk to Stephen Wright, but that's fine, because the last thing you said reminded me of something, which is I grew up in the Boston area. Sounds like you did, too.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like everybody I knew was a comedian.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So many comedians come from the Boston area, and I don't know why that is, if you have any ideas on how that happened.
No, I think you're right, and I'm not sure exactly why that is, but I mean, two things I remember about growing up there, and of course I go down to visit quite often, and you know, it's there's a certain negativity also. It's not all fun and games, because a lot of people walk around, it seems like, with a chip on their shoulders or something, just if there's a general cultural attitude to a region of the country. I sometimes find that there's a little bit of a snarl
it's not personal.
No, it's not personal. It's just like we're all stuck in traffic together here on I-93, and it really is not a lot of fun, and but we're gonna sort of just wisecrack our way through it, I guess. Is that the idea?
Yeah, a bunch of wise guys. Yeah, my wife, when I first met her, introduced to my friends. She said, "Your friends don't like me." I said, "No, they do. They wouldn't talk to you like that if they didn't like you."
Yeah, that I'll tell you, I've run into situations like that too, where somebody comes in from another part of the country or something. I remember in high school, this girl moved in, and I was talking to her about how she likes living around here, and she says, everybody's so unhappy and everybody's so negative, and I was saying, no, this is just sort of the local sense of humor that people I find that there's as much positivity just in your general daily interactions around there as in any other place I've ever been. But you kind of have to know how to find it. You have to listen for it, and it doesn't.
I heard about that word, that sense of humor, that kind of undertone. Some of my I could swear that half of my friends could have been stand-up comics if they put their mind to it.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Half of your friends could have been stand-up comics, and the other half thought they could have been stand-up comics. It is kind of an amazing thing, I'm sorry?
You felt that too, growing up, that I didn't realize till I moved that not everybody had that sense of humor, and I go to college, and everyone's like, "What's wrong with this?"
You know what I think it was? It might have been that sort of dim view of the world that also, was just absolutely steeped in irony and steeped in kind of like wacky humor and stuff. I think it might have come from all those years of watching the Red Sox when they went that long drought.
That's part of it. It's a mixture of everything that forms your culture and for that many people to react kind of the same way to the same things.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of, a lot of input.
It's a distinct.
I remember my grandmother would say, "It's a nice day." He'd say, "No, I saw a cloud."
I'm sorry, say that again?
My grandfather, you'd say it's a nice day to him. He's saying, "Well, I saw a cloud."
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a cloud up there. Yeah. I saw a cloud. That is a, That sounds like something you'd hear in that part of the world. And to me, it's sort of, it's kind of like an accent, except that it's not just in speech and so on. It actually has a, it's in the overall kind of approach to life, I guess.
It's your body language involved.
When you
see these.
Well, fascinating. Where down there did you grow up, Mike?
I was born in Everett.
Uh-huh. And
a little bit further north of,
yep,
further up the North Shore, eventually.
Oh yeah, I know Everett, and we used to. I remember there was it was Chelsea that had the really really weak high school band. I played in my high school band, and Chelsea was the only band on the entire North Shore that was worse than ours.
Chelsea was weak in a lot of areas.
Yeah, well, you're from Everett, so I'm sure there's a little bit of cross town rivalry. Yep. Hey, Mike, thanks for the call. I really appreciate it. I think we're going to lose a lot of Vermonters here if we keep talking about all this Boston stuff, so I got to let you go, but I appreciate it. Thanks so much. All right, 244-1777 is the toll-free number. 1-877-291-8255 is the first one was the local number, 244-1777. 1-877-291-8255, and I got to figure out if I'm on the red line or the blue line here or something. So, anyway, Mike from Everett, some of the towns down there have just great pronunciations, even in the town names. It's Revia, and Everett, and Somerville, and Medford, etc. So you got to. It's a wacky place, wacky part of the world. Hey. If anybody has any thoughts about anything we've covered so far here on the show, I got a minute left here or so before the bottom of the hour CBS break. We're going to actually be talking to Senator Dick Sears, another guy I think who grew up in Massachusetts, so we might have to reminisce with him a little bit too. He's a Democrat from Bennington these days, and he is going to be talking to us about some of the sort of the warm-up season. Maybe it's spring training, fall training or something, for the legislature session starts in January, and it seems like lawmakers are already starting to meet with a greater degree of frequency and intensity and discussing some of the heavy issues that are going to be coming up. So we're going to get a little bit of a taste from Senator Dick Sears in the last half hour of the program this morning. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news just upcoming, and a couple words from our sponsors, and love to have you stay with us for this last half hour in our conversation with Senator Dick Sears. We'll be back.
Stick season is the perfect time for a road trip. It's an easy drive from anywhere to visit our perfect piece of paradise in Warren Village. Have lunch in our rockin' deli and venture upstairs to a shopper's treasure trove of toys, gifts, cards, accessories, and beautiful functional clothing for every lifestyle. Brands you know and love, Cool, Toad & Co., Royal Robbins, share the space with fashion-forward brands like Tonya Debellis and Comfy, Smart Wool, Darn Tough, and more upstairs at the almost world-famous Warren Store, Warren Village, Vermont.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back for the last half hour of our program this morning, and I'm going to be talking, I think, very shortly with Senator Richard Sears, Democrat of Bennington County. He's on the Appropriations Committee. He's on the chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Vermont Senate, and he's been attending some hearings recently. For instance, I think the Joint Fiscal Committee was meeting on Monday and talking about a bit of environmental spending on a cleanup in Burlington. So we may get a couple of words from Senator Sears about that. The state is trying to recover some money from a couple of companies who may have been involved in some dry cleaning pollution up there. And I believe he's on the line now. Senator Sears, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Is my theory correct that this time of year might be the legislature's version of spring training, or is it fall training or something?
Well, it seems like it's becoming more and more of a full-time job.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, but do you meet more? You meet more often in October and November than you do in July and August, right?
Yeah, July and August are pretty much very quiet. Although, with all of the changes in the that we're looking at, like justice reinvestment and the effort to lower prison population and so forth. The Justice Oversight Committee and the Justice Reinvestment Working Group have been fairly busy since the end of the session.
Yeah, I just saw your name in the news, I think, in the last, 24 hours or so. Might have been a VT Digger story where they were talking about you commenting on a request for $150,000.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, that was just a request from the city of Burlington and on Elmwood Avenue, and it's from the Environmental Contingency Fund. There have been 8 or 9 homes in that area that have been getting fumes from discharge into the Burlington sewer system and water system of chemicals from a dry cleaning operation. And the question I had for the person who was in front of the Joint Fiscal Committee was only if they were looking at the city of Burlington or just the dry cleaner, because there were problems with the city of Burlington system.
The sewer pipe, I guess this is a chemical, I believe, called PCE, which is said to raise, I don't know, you can directly call this thing a carcinogen, but it is alleged to increase the risk of various types of cancer.
Yeah, obviously, those of us here in Bennington have been dealing with the PFOA crisis, and, we did get help from the Environmental Contingency Fund. That was very good, but I just wondered about, not looking at the city of Burlington and their responsibility for fixing old lines.
So the theory of your case would be, listen, if the PCE goes into the sewer from the dry cleaners and then leaks out into somebody's basement and causes contamination in a person's home, needs remediation, some of that cost ought to be on the city for improper...
Asked the question.
Yeah. Okay. Asking the question, should some of the cost be on the city for insufficient maintenance of its sewer lines?
Yeah. And I think you'll find that throughout. We're hearing a lot about, city and other municipal sewer lines spilling into lakes and rivers and so forth, and the contamination that goes along with that.
I
just think, we need to look at all of those.
I bet you your question kind of, I don't know if there was anybody from the Vermont League of Cities and Towns in the room, but I bet you they would kind of freak out.
Yikes.
but that's the way these things
are. Again, I definitely don't want citizens harmed, and the people on Elmwood Avenue certainly aren't at fault in this case. And they need to have the contamination taken care of, and I certainly was supportive of the motion to allow the $150,000.
Yeah, do you think that's enough, or is that just sort of down payment?
That's the starting point. Yeah. And they're in court with the insurance company, as I understand it, with the insurance company for the dry cleaner.
Okay, well, that's more to come on that, I would suspect.
Yep.
Lots of other issues that are actually more in your bailiwick. When I think of you, of course, I think of issues related to our criminal justice system, legal system. Longtime chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. How long have you been in that seat, by the way?
As chair, it would be starting my 24th year next year.
Wow. So that's quite a career. And
it is a long time, man.
What are the top three issues that are going to be in front of your committee as the legislature reconvenes in January? Well,
the top, obviously, is criminal and juvenile justice reform. And we are going through a process called justice reinvestment. And this is our second time going through that. We did it in 2010. We saw a reduction of about 500 beds in our out-of-state system. And we're hoping to get some results from justice reinvestment, too. But I want to caution everyone that, to me, justice reinvestment means three things. One is that whatever you do as a result of data-driven information, you make sure that any reduction in prison population will also result in a lower crime rate. And you do that by reinvesting the money that's saved in prison beds into the communities or whatever programming you're doing. And that's what we did under Justice Reinvestment 1. And we did, with that plus the war on recidivism, we did see a drop in the crime rate. And frankly, I think that's the important part for the public to be aware of. And I actually spoke to the ACLU when they came out with their plan about the fact that that wasn't part of their, they didn't have anything about that. And I said, I hope that we're in agreement that whatever we do can't adversely impact public safety. A lot of people who are incarcerated, in my opinion anyway, need to be. There are other people who are incarcerated that may not need to be, and that's part of the data-driven process that we're going through.
Do you fear sometimes that there's a pendulum that swings back and forth and you do end up with an uptick in crime sometimes if you've been working for years on a policy to reduce incarceration or to shorten sentences, whatever the strategy is? I've watched this as a reporter for a long time too. And it seems like we've gone through a couple of phases where, the general theme in your committee is it's time to get tough. And then there's other times when the general theme is it's time to, put the brakes on or something.
Well, let me use the example of the sex offenders.
Yeah.
And I believe that prior to the Brooks Bennett murder, a lot of us, and I don't think the state was particularly, our laws needed to be updated in dealing with sex offenders. And we did that following that murder, as you remember. We also did a lot of prevention work, and we also did work in schools, and we set up child advocacy centers and special investigative units. Now, that results in an increase in convictions and an increase in reporting, but I'm not sure there was an increase in the rate of sex abuse.
Excuse me.
We just made it, I think, better and easier for victims to report the crimes, easier for law enforcement to solve the crimes, and so forth. So I think that while you may say, oh, wow, there's been an uptick in sex offenses, I don't think necessarily that's true. It's just, I believe it was way underreported before. It's still underreported, but I think that that's part of the whole process. So if you want to use that as an example, I think we have gotten tougher. We've had longer sentences, and that's resulting in some of the increase that we're seeing and an uptick in the number of people incarcerated.
Do you think that...
Small number, but it's still there.
Yeah. One of the big issues coming up in the connection with the criminal justice system in the coming session, I think, just from what I'm reading and hearing, is going to have to do with this pivot point between someone being insane or criminally culpable or criminally insane or, somewhere in that range.
Let's say that that's another issue that we will be confronting this year. In Senate Judiciary and House Judiciary, I'm sure.
We had these three big cases where Chittenden County State's Attorney Sarah George dismissed charges, saying that the defense was raising an issue of insanity, essentially, as a defense, and that she said, "Well, we really can't disprove that, and we're going to drop these charges as a result." That very much upset the governor as well as a number of other people.
Well, I think what is upsetting about it is that it highlighted a problem in our system, in my view. And the not guilty by reason of insanity does not mean the person was not guilty of the crime. It means they're not held to be incarcerated or whatever else the Department of Corrections might do as a result of the crime, and instead they're dealt with by the Department of Mental Health as not guilty by reason of insanity. And when it comes to somebody who has been proven to have been, they have the proof, usually the person's admitted that they committed the murder, and then you have only a 90-day hold on that person with the Department of Mental Health, who then may release them into either a less restrictive environment or even back into the community, that has upset a lot of victims, rightly so, and a lot of other people. And it really is about the safety of the community. So what we're looking at is the ability of the system, and one draft of the bill, and I urge people to just, this is just a draft, would allow for a 3-year hold in a very serious crimes like murder and attempted murder. The other thing would be some way to deal with the HIPAA requirement that you not notify victims, but somehow giving victims a say in the process. Back years ago when we had the juvenile system, victims weren't a part of that system. They are now.
Mm-hmm.
But the victims have to agree to keep the proceedings confidential. There is a way to deal with the HIPAA requirement, but you have to do something statutorily.
And HIPAA, of course, applies in the mental health system very, very strongly.
Well, because we consider mental health to be a sickness and
yep.
an illness. I mean, that's, and so it's defined that way, and HIPAA covers that process, as it should. It's the right thing to do. But on the other hand, when people are getting out, somehow they find themselves, when they're released, somehow they find themselves back into the criminal justice system. Case in point, one of the people who, was convicted, I believe, in Windsor County, found not guilty by reason of insanity, is now back in jail on some other charge. So it's not like they're not ending up somewhere in the system. And we also want to look at whether or not there should be a forensic unit with either within the Department of Corrections or the Department of Mental Health, which would deal with people who have committed crimes and are deemed to be not guilty by reason of insanity.
We have a caller on the line. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Senator Sears.
Good morning.
Once again, I think this is probably only the second time I've talked to you, Senator, in about 8 years or so, and my head wanted to explode again today like it did many years ago. And what I'm referencing is, I think you just made a comment about sexual abuse cases, and it kind of flies in the face of something that you mentioned years ago on the Mark Johnson's show when you were talking to him about the Catholic sexual abuse cases. And you actually, I quoted you because I called in to chastise you because you referred to them as nothing more than a lot to do about a little touching. I'm just wondering where
not.
This transformation
I,
can...
I yes, disagree
you,
with
yes,
you, sir.
Yes, you
I disagree
did.
With your with your allegation that I referred to it as a little touch. I
no,
did not. I remember the case.
That is you, not. That's exactly what you said.
No,
I,
it isn't,
you,
sir.
I can get Mark Johnson come on and talk about it. Because I had called you on it, and you said, I misspoke, is what you said. But those were your exact words.
Well...
Okay, well, I don't... I know what I said, and I did
I
not
do too.
Say that.
Yes, you did.
Paul, I tell you what.
You didn't have a question. You just wanted to berate me.
I don't think we're going to. I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of who said what. I don't have a tape. Let's call it on this one, Paul. Do you have a question? Paul's gone? Okay. Thanks for the call, Paul. I think it's sometimes helpful to think about what you're going to be bringing up on the show here, because if you're going to do something like that, it's important to have some way of having the question resolved. As if you're going to raise an allegation that somebody said something, you need to be able to, I don't know exactly how that would be resolved immediately, but
what I was referring to at the time, and I remember the call,
uh-huh.
was that, and I never said that it was just a little touch. Well, I don't believe I ever said that. What I was referring to, there are different, the sexual abuse is horrible no matter what, but there are different offenses. Some more are held more seriously than others within the criminal justice system, hence the sentences are different.
I get it. Okay, Senator Sears, another subject, actually, while we are on a little bit difficult ones, Norm McAllister was acquitted a couple of weeks ago by a jury up there in Franklin County, where he had been, as you know, faced several sex crime charges when he was first arrested back in 2015. And he described the justice system as fickle, because I said to him, I said, Norm, you know, on the same set of facts, this this idea that you had prostituted a tenant or a worker on your farm and, you know, basically offered her to a friend of yours for money, effectively. You were adjudicated as guilty at one point and now not guilty. And I said, what does that mean about the justice system? And he said, it's fickle. And you're someone who's with very keen oversight on the justice system there. Do you agree?
Well, I think there are different, there's geographic differences in justice in the state of Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
You have 14 different state's attorneys.
Yep. Of course, and these are both Franklin County verdicts. So that
right. And what is prosecuted in Chittenden County may be entirely different from what's prosecuted in Bennington County or in Franklin County. So a case of prostitution, for example, may be prosecuted in Chittenden County. It may not be prosecuted in Chittenden County. They may, you know, refer it to diversion or whatever. But in Franklin County, they decided to prosecute. And I think that's, you know, what all of us are trying. One of the things that the Attorney General tried to deal with by taking over the diversion programs was to have more uniform justice in terms of which crimes are getting diverted into the diversion system versus which aren't. So in other words, if you pass a bad check in Bennington County for $100 and you're going before a judge and might even be incarcerated, but the same crime would be dismissed or not even taken before a judge and diverted before pretrial, or pre-charge, excuse me, is that fair to the in the system?
Do you think that it was fair to, I mean, now Norm McAllister has been cleared effectively by the justice system. He is in the clear now. He's got this final acquittal, and all the other charges are either dropped or I think there was, I don't remember right now, all the bouncing ball aspects of the thing. But the bottom line here is the Senate suspended him and effectively ended his political career at the beginning of 2016. Was that fair?
I don't know. I really don't. I think that at the time, given the facts that we had, I thought we made a decision that was in the best interests of the state of Vermont and the people of Franklin County.
Guy Page, I was mentioning him earlier, is a friend of the Dave Graham Show, and he's a conservative commentator on state house issues. And his question is whether you think racial disparities among the incarcerated population in Vermont, in other words, Vermont has a population of people of color in its prison system that is out of scale with the population of people of color in the general population, he says, ask him if he thinks that is true, is due in part to big city organized drug gangs operating in Vermont.
I honestly don't know. And that's part of what we're trying to find out through Justice Reinvestment, too, is why we have the disparities.
There'd probably be a way to just sort of count the percentage of folks who are incarcerated in Vermont and say how many of them are there on drug charges. That would be a first.
It may, in fact, there may be some of that, but I don't think it explains the entire problem and of the racial disparities. I think it's, personally, I find, you know, it's difficult to ascribe it to an opiate problem when, you know, there are, I'm sure, some people who are incarcerated in Vermont who came from Albany, New York, Troy, New York, or, you know, other places,
mm-hmm.
who are persons of color, but it does not explain the entire racial disparities within our criminal justice system. And that's something we're trying to deal with. And I think that that's an easy way to try to get around it, but it is there. I was at Woodside last spring, and why were there two persons of color there out of, I think, 10 kids? That would be neither one of them, to my knowledge, was involved in drugs. So why were two persons of color there when that would be about 20% of their population at the time?
The Jay Diaz of the American Civil Liberties Union has done a study making the point that these disparities seem to extend back, you know, if you roll it all back into our schools and kids who are getting suspended, there's a racial disparity there as well.
Yeah, I think there is, but I, again, we're trying to get, we had a discussion in a meeting last week about the number of kids who are truant, and we don't even have statewide figures on that to know, and so I think we can all speculate on why something's happening.
Yeah.
But I think that we need to get to a point where incarceration, suspension, all of that has nothing to do with race or any other minority, any other factor.
You have so many huge and seemingly intractable problems on your plate. Do you ever get discouraged?
Yeah, at times. I think there are people today with social media and so forth, and you know, that take.
I should have asked that question with more time left. I apologize,
yeah,
but unfortunately,
I do get discouraged. But I know that, you know, you see actual results. And, like the results we saw from Justice Reinvestment 1.
That's got to help, too. Hey, Senator Dick Sears, I got to go, but I really appreciate you giving us some time this morning. Thank you so much.
No problem. Bye now.
That's about it for the Dave Graham Show here on this Tuesday morning. Folks, stay tuned for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and have a great day, everybody.